Breaking news today on Seculo as a post-election victory for Trump legal team in New York.
Keeping you informed and engaged, now more than ever. This is Seculo. We want to hear from you. Share and post your comments or call 1-800-684-3110. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
All right, folks, welcome to Seculo. We are taking your calls too, 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. There is a victory for President Trump out of the case in New York. This is the case brought by DA Alvin Bragg. Remember, sentencing was supposed to be, was it November 19th, Will, that the actual sentencing?
November 26th the sentencing date.
That is the sentencing date on those 34 felony counts as well as misdemeanors. And the question now is, will those felony counts survive? Will the misdemeanors survive? And the victory here is that the judge who was going to decide today on how the Supreme Court case on presidential immunity affected the case by Alvin Bragg and ultimately the verdicts in this case has now actually put a hold on that date and has moved it until November 19th. That was a request put forward by the Trump team, that Trump legal team, that ultimately the DA's team joined as well. So you had the Trump legal team say, we want a delay. We want to have more briefing on this now that he is president-elect. So add that to the mix, that during a transition is a actual, it's an actual governmental time period where you are, you open up an office, you have resources as an incoming president and vice president to put together your team and utilize background check systems, FBI systems for people that will require clearance, all of that. So this is, even though you're president-elect, you are in an official position through the transition. So that also can affect the immunity issue out of the court. That briefing will be done. And then ultimately, by the end of November, sometime right around Thanksgiving, we should have a final decision by Judge Mershon. And I would say at this point, things are looking better and better for President Trump each day with this delay, because now they're going to be considering another issue that the judge has with trying to go forward with any kind of sentencing, because we're now in a official transition period.
That's right, Jordan. And this stay of the decision whether or not to dismiss the case because of the Supreme Court decision on immunity was granted by Judge Mershon, and he has requested that the people, so the state of New York, DA Bragg's office, file with the court off calendar your view of appropriate steps going forward. And that filing is no later than 10 a.m. on November 19th. So next Tuesday, they have a week to get this brief in. But I want to read you this from the request from DA Bragg's office when they were asking, joining the Trump team, to grant this stay on the immunity decision, because all of their briefing was in the context of the election hadn't happened yet. So everyone now wants to say, look, now there are extenuating circumstances. But this line makes you think that the DA is trying to decide how to proceed very carefully. The people agree that these are unprecedented circumstances and that the arguments raised by defense counsel in correspondence to the people on Friday require careful consideration to ensure that any further steps in this proceeding appropriately balance the competing interests of, one, a jury verdict of guilt following a trial that has a presumption of regularity, and two, the office of the president. They understand these are large constitutional ramifications, and they're about to tell the judge how they think the judge would proceed. And we're going to get into what maybe some of those scenarios could be. We won't know until ultimately, but stick around for the next segment to hear some of the ways this could play out.
Yep, folks, 1-800-684-3110. If you've got questions about that or other issues, we're going to be talking about outstanding races and the balance of power, as well as those who have been named, at least some haven't been confirmed, others have, to join President Trump's White House team and cabinet. We'll go through some of those as well. Support the work of the ACLJ. Just hours ago, we actually filed a critical brief in a federal court to defend election integrity. It's still going. That fight is still ongoing as races are still being counted, and we're prepared to file at the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. Donate today. Have your gift doubled. ACLJ.org. Donate. Seculo. So, in the broadcast today, we're going to walk through these remaining seats that have not yet been called. Of course, the most news outlets have the Republicans maintaining control of the House of Representatives and, of course, a U.S. Senate majority. There will be a vote tomorrow. It is done in secret to elect the next majority leader of the U.S. Senate. That vote, again, is done in secret with senators only. We know some names that are out there. Of course, Rick Scott has been one that has been kind of, I think, on the rise because he is seen as closest to President Trump, who will be the president that this Senate will be working with for, you know, at least 4 years. So you've got that, but you've also then got two major players kind of unrelated to the election, but big fundraisers for other senators. That would be, of course, John Thune, who I think raised the most money for other senators who are running in races and thus distributed that money out, as well as John Cornyn from Texas. So you've got at least three. There could be more. It's done in secret. There have been some endorsements made. I know Senator Hagerty of Tennessee is supporting Rick Scott because he thinks with the election shift, they've got to have somebody at the top of the Senate who has a good working relationship with President Trump. It's done behind closed doors. So we'll know when we know, and we'll be able to announce it for you. The other situation, and this is, again, big, really is breaking news, because I want to go to Harry Hutchinson, because, Harry, we were supposed to have today a decision on from the New York judge, Judge Merchan, on whether or not President-elect's convictions could withstand the Supreme Court case and the presidential immunity case specifically. These are the 34 felonies and the misdemeanors that go with them that were brought by Alvin Bragg that everyone thought was a weak case to begin with once it moves out of district court, or even ultimately on appeal, because of the way they were trying to utilize federal law and mix it in with state law, even though they are not federal prosecutors. But the big question now really is, how does the case come to an end? And we thought we might get that decision at some time today, but the Trump team asked, and then the Bragg team decided to join in a request to delay that decision. Harry, the sentencing is not until November 26th. They have frozen the case until November 19th. And the question now is, does this political period of the transition, where the president has won and now is president-elect, and the transition process is an official part of the government, so to have that transfer of power, these are official acts going on and appointments that are being made for the incoming president, by the incoming president. So how much more does that even damage the case from Alvin Bragg? So where do you think you see it going at this point?
Well, I could foresee this case simply going away, but the case really starts, and the problems start, with judicial malpractice by Judge Merchan. He allowed into evidence, contested evidence, with respect to Donald Trump's core presidential powers, and that particular decision came into full relief after the Supreme Court's decision in the U.S. versus Trump case, basically disallowing or providing constitutional immunity to presidents for core official acts, and limited or presumptive immunity with respect to other official acts. So Judge Merchan decided to allow into evidence, and the jurors heard this, and therefore they reached their verdict on the basis of contested evidence. And so I think a constitutional lawyer would argue that this case ought to disappear. Now, that's a tough decision. It implicates both the judge and the prosecution in this case, but even the prosecutor's office believes that there is indeed a basis for at least staying sentencing, staying the verdict, and perhaps avoiding the case. But I think at the end of the day, the judge might decide simply to defer any judgment until 2028, 2029, after President Trump has served his full 4-year term.
Yeah, I mean, so Well, most people look at this as a game of how quick are they going to wrap these up. And the Trump team says, you know, in their email, for instance, the special counsel's office sought the stay relief, and they are now considering dismissing all of their prosecutions in Washington, D.C. The same thing is happening in Florida out of federal cases there on whether or not the special counsel is even a constitutional position, which, though we filed in, unfortunately, looks like we won't get to a final say on that matter this time around, which means you could still, I guess, appoint special counsels if you are president with just that one district court outstanding. But it's certainly something we should probably be dealing with over the next 4 years, because we've seen the abuse of these special counsels now for 8 years straight. And it has been abusive and ridiculous, and the amount of taxpayer money that's gone to them is just absolutely absurd. But it does look like on the federal side, we are coming to a quick close, and that is because there is a law, just so people know, the U.S. There is the Presidential Transition Act of 1963, and that makes it very clear that this is an official act of the president-elect. This is an official part of the government that is acting right now to go forward and vet these candidates and ultimately announce your cabinet and go through the process of those who have to be confirmed, others who will be advisors.
That's right. And the peaceful transfer of power, which the left has tried to bring up so many times, that isn't just on Inauguration Day or the certification day in the Congress. This begins now because there are national security briefings that are happening for the president-elect. There are security buildup. There are working with the GAO to start setting up offices and how that runs. And many times it's not someone who has been a president before. You know, only once in our history has it been someone who's actually been the president before that wasn't just continuing on.
He has a lot of his team will still be new, like a new group of folks.
Exactly. So there's a lot of even instruction in learning about how to operate the executive branch that has to go on. And what the concern, and I know that Judge Mershon is weighing this, and the DA even, of, hey, if we step into this right now, this could have real implications on even national security. If for some reason we try to go maximum penalty or even a slight penalty, say throw him in jail for 36 hours, you know, that really has implications on the United States. I think what the legal pundits on all the news media are getting paid overtime today because of the uniqueness of what is going on with this. But there's across the board really many options that the judge could weigh here. Could he, as Harry Hutchison said, freeze the case entirely for 4 years and let this dangle over the president's head until he's 83 years old and then say, you're out of office now. Let's go ahead and move forward with sentencing. I think that would have big trouble on appeal for the district attorney's office, who may not even be the district attorney anymore at that point. But then you also have to think about, could he say, you know, we're going to do a fine, get this out, and still enter the judgment? Or does he throw it out entirely? There are many people that even brought up the left is loving to call him a convicted felon. However, yes, the jury did render a guilty verdict. That judgment hasn't been entered in until Judge Mershon enters that in with the sentencing. So there's a lot of different areas here that could completely change the narrative of this. What it all boils down to me, Jordan, is their lawfare is coming to an end. They waited to bring these charges until it would be inflicting the most amount of damage on President Trump running for office. Now that grift is up as far as the political angle of this. It is time to move forward. And if they are truly wanting to unite America, which I don't believe they want to unite America behind President Trump, they would say, you know what? We tried. This is the course of it. The American people, the largest jury pool in America, have spoken overwhelmingly that they want President Donald Trump as the next president of the United States.
This question quickly from John so Harry can answer it. Hey, John in Illinois, on line one, you're on the air. Quickly.
Yes, just real quick, two quick questions. One, is there not some way to fast track this whole thing to a higher court to get an actual official decision on this? And then number two, doesn't the Trump team have some kind of way to prosecute this judge for the malicious way he's conducted this entire
trial? All right,
trial.
So Harry, on number one, you don't want to move it any forward because this judge is looking at ways to toss it out. If he doesn't and tries to put a hold on it, then you can move forward. Second, on any kind of malicious, this is the judge doing this. The judge just got assigned this case. He gave the instructions out. It was a jury who came back with a decision, not the judge.
Absolutely. And yes, President Trump could appeal any decision rendered by this particular judge, but that is hugely difficult for this judge in the sense that it's the judge's own misconduct, arguably, that triggered all of this, but that would be decided on appeal.
Right. So, folks, the election was a week ago, but our work to defend election integrity is far from over. We've got more than a dozen House races. Can you believe that in America? A week after the election, a dozen House races are still too close to call. So figuring out what the balance of power truly looks like in the House of Representatives, the radical left is desperately filing lawsuits to try and allow illegal votes and get all these votes that haven't been corrected in. So we are fighting back. And just hours ago, we filed a critical brief in federal court to defend election integrity now and in the future. We're prepared to take it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. Donate today. Welcome back to Seculo. I do want to take this call. Greg's been holding on line two out of Michigan. Hey, Greg, you're on the air. Oh, Greg is no longer there in Michigan, but if he wants to call back, he can, or if any others do, 1-800-684-3110. We did want to break down for you both where the administration, incoming administration is quickly, and then look at these outstanding House races that could really determine how much the balance of power swings towards Republicans, or is it going to be a razor thin majority for the House. We know the Senate is hovering right around, is going to be at 53. So what will the House look like? We'll get to that in just a second. First, these are the Trump cabinet picks that have been confirmed by President Trump. Some of these, again, we believe will be cabinet. I guess border czar could become a cabinet position up to President Trump. So chief of staff, obviously, Susie Wiles, that was announced early. She ran the campaign. She's been an operative in politics for a long time, going back to the days of Ronald Reagan, Jeb Bush as governor, DeSantis's races, and both President Trump's previous races as well. And then, of course, this race where she was campaign manager. The UN ambassador was the first big position outside the White House that was announced. That was Elise Stefanik, who is a very good friend of ours and getting a lot of bipartisan support from another good friend of ours, a Democrat in the House of Representatives, Jared Moskowitz, who immediately came out and said she will be very strong, especially in defending U.S. and Israel at the United Nations. We know for EPA, Lee Zeldin, who's a very popular figure in the conservative realm, after leaving Congress, ran for governor of New York, came up a bit short, but has stayed as someone who's been very helpful to the Republican Party, expanding the base. So he will be at EPA. Now, we've got media reports, but these haven't been confirmed by the Trump team. So again, if it's not fully confirmed, we just want to leave that caveat there in case something does change. For Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem. Kristi Noem is, of course, this South Dakota governor. We have actually represented the South Dakota governor. She requested the ACLJ represent the state in a matter. We did, and we won. So a good relationship there with the ACLJ. Then you've got a deputy chief of staff for policy. That would be Stephen Miller. He is a longstanding Trump stalwart, especially on domestic policy and immigration issues. Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Of course, you're all very familiar with Senator Rubio. He's run for president before, so he's got a very much a national presence. Though he looks young, he's been in the Senate a long time. He is a specialist kind of in national security and foreign policy, and has built that up during his time in the Senate, and would look like a pretty smooth confirmation if that is in fact confirmed, later on today or soon by the Trump transition team. And then you've got a national security advisor that does not need confirmation. Neither does deputy chief of staff or chief of staff or border czar. But national security advisor, a huge position, and that would go to Congressman Mike Waltz. That means that as of right now, two current members of Congress will be leaving Congress to take these positions in January. So let's transfer on to then where we look in the House of Representatives knowing that at least two members of Congress will likely not be there.
That's right. So this is also why the ACLJ is standing ready in case there does need to be some sort of filings, legal filings in some of these states. As these races are called, they're never officially over until the state certifies the election. Yes. But as you look at this, different news organizations that have an apparatus to collect the data and make projections based off of any outstanding votes make their different calls. Decision Desk HQ, which has been around for about 20 years and has made a lot of waves in the forecasting of projected winners. A lot of news organizations that don't have their own apparatus use Decision Desk HQ. So it's not this random out there organization. They are a approved, one of the big six that call elections. They have already called the House of Representatives for the Republicans. They put them at 219 to 210. Organizations like CNN, New York Times, they have not yet called the House, and they have the Republicans at 215 versus 206 with some outstanding states. Now, being at 219, very good. That would put, if the Democrats swept all the outstanding, it would put us at 219 to 216, taking two members of the House out. The Republicans, until those seats are filled with a special election, they would be vacant seats.
So let's explain this to people because we're getting a lot of questions on this.
That's right.
In the House of Representatives, there's no appointment.
Correct.
So you don't have like a governor or state legislature that appoints a member of the House for the remainder of the term. Instead, each state will decide when to put forward. They usually have rules on dates. So whenever this person technically resigns, there has to be a special election within so many days to fill that seat. So that's how the seats of, at least for right now, Elise Stefanik and Mike Waltz would be filled. But right. Until they're filled, it takes what you need necessary to have the House majority. That number drops by two.
That's right, because the total membership of the House drops because there are vacant seats. So even if it's at Decision Desk HQ's number, and those two members leave a vacant seat, the Republicans, based off today, if Democrats were to sweep the remaining, would still have a one-vote majority. They would remain the majority party. You couldn't lose any more due to illness, death, resignation, anything of that nature. But it also looks like there are a few other areas that the Republicans should get around 220 to 219, 221.
Outstanding. There's 10 outstanding.
It depends on who you're looking at, but according
to the
broadest of terms, it looks like there are about six outstanding.
Six outstanding.
According to Decision Desk HQ.
How many could Republicans potentially win of those?
Potentially two, puts you up to 221.
Push you up to 221. So there you go.
And now, I do have one caveat for you, Jordan, and this is where we have to stay vigilant.
Yeah.
Decision Desk HQ called the Iowa House District 1 for the Republican, but that Republican won by 796 votes. Republican Party, the political party, and outside legal observers need to make sure that there are no shenanigans, because that's a very slim margin. It has been called for the Republican. It's not a very populous district. However, there's most likely going to be a recount there. We need to make sure that that remains in the Republican column to ensure that stays up to the...
One of these races, they've only counted 57% of
votes? Then you go out to California.
I mean, think about that, folks. That's just not right a week after the election. I mean, they need to explain to the voters what happened that they've only counted 57% of the votes in a week.
And that is where an incumbent Republican, John Duarte, and is facing off against Adam Gray, a Democrat. He's ahead by 3,000 votes, the Republican. However, as of right now, there is only 57% of the vote in. We are a week past the election day. Why is California unable to get these votes processed?
Yeah. I mean, there's really no excuse unless they haven't told us that something went wrong. Was it a staffing issue, machine issue? Are they having some problem with votes that went through the machines? Like, is there something else at play here? I mean, or is it just that they don't have enough people to count? I mean, there's got to be a reason. There's just no excuse that's been put forward. So they haven't put forward an excuse or reason. We have to watch those very carefully when the margins are this slim. And as Will said, some of the victory margins are slim, like under 1,000 votes as well. It's why it's time to support the work of the ACLJ. It's our most critical time of the year. It determines the resources that we have to finish out the year and to begin the year ahead, which is going to be a very busy time. Lots of confirmations, lots of battles in Washington, D.C. We need you to stand with us with your support today. Go to ACLJ.org and donate today. Double your gift.
Keeping you informed and engaged now more than ever. This is Seculo. And now your host, Jordan Seculo.
All right, welcome back to Seculo. We are taking your calls too, 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. Our director of ACLJ Jerusalem, Jeff Balaban, has just arrived in Israel. He is trying to get to his the office there so he can connect with us to provide an update on, of course, the excitement inside Israel because of the election of President Trump, but also some of these actions we've seen around the world and upcoming events that could be of concern. So we were hoping to connect with him before the show is over today, so you want to stay tuned for that. We do want to go to the phones as well, 1-800-684-3110. Over these last couple weeks, some of these shows, you know, we've had lots of calls come in. It was just tough to get to all the calls. We're trying to get to more now that we've got time to kind of talk through things and work through things as they come in, as we're post-election. Let's go to Roberta in Colorado on line one. Hey, Roberta, welcome to Jay Seculo. Well, welcome to Seculo. You're on the air.
Thank you very much. I wanted to just say, if he keeps pulling from our Senate and House, there's such a thin line there for special elections. But I think you guys covered that in the previous segment.
Yeah, I mean, well,
so I'm going to go ahead and hang up and listen to you.
Okay, so we covered the House. And for anyone who missed that, I do want to explain that because we didn't do the difference, which was with the Senate.
Right.
So let's first start with the House. First, Will, you said Steve Scalise, a leader, part of a leadership in the House of Representatives, has made a statement that's very clear to President Trump that...
That's right. He said that the number of people you can pull from the House has now been met. So basically, don't pull any more people from the House for your administration because we need to keep a majority and able to continue on with this agenda. So that number has been met as far as the leadership in the House is concerned. And I'm certain that President Trump will take that to heart as he's making more picks as he goes along.
Yes. And so the Senate, different. So let's just explain that people for quickly. A senator is removed, and typically that's appointed by that term because they can be a much longer term, is appointed. The remainder of that term is appointed by a governor.
So typically, yes, the governor will appoint an interim senator to fill that seat. And typically that person is who they are going to let run. There's not normally a primary. Sometimes there is. But then around the next election cycle, there will be a special election for the remainder of that term. Sometimes there is a placeholder senator until they decide who the party wants to run for that seat. But there will be immediately a senator that is appointed by the governor. So in Marco Rubio's case, the only senator on this list so far, he will be appointed by Governor Ron DeSantis, will appoint the replacement to hold that
the
seat.
Next election cycle.
And then
there,
the next election cycle, there will be a special election to fill out the remainder of Rubio's term. So it's not even a full election. It doesn't reset the clock.
I'm not sure where he wasn't up for re-election this time, right? So that would mean he's only got 2 or 4 years left.
Correct.
But again, so you'd have that special election for the remainder of his term, and then you get back on track after that. There are sometimes placeholders put in, you know, a governor's chief of staff, somebody who's going to be very loyal, vote, and is not looking to make this necessarily a career, but they're going to do this for this interim period while Republicans determine who's going to run in that special election. And so we've seen both of those things occur. That's why in the Senate, it's not you can kind of keep picking and choosing as long as you're picking and choosing from red states.
That's right. So also J.D. Vance is in a red state.
Right.
He will now be vacating his seat because he will be the vice president of the United States. Governor DeWine in Ohio will be able to pick a successor until a special election can be held. So it's a Republican state. Now, a place like North Carolina, where you have Republican senators, but a Democrat governor was just picked, you're not going to pick a Republican senator for your administration, because then you would be basically conceding a seat to the Democrats. So look out for that. That won't happen.
If you got more questions about this process of putting together the cabinet and the president's leadership team, give us a call, 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. You know from us, we believe this can be, it's a very dangerous time in the country. One, you got a lot of angry people about President Trump's victory. You've seen them attempt to use the lawfare. We've seen how Jim Comey tried to use the first 2 days in the White House to send in agents to really start creating havoc on day two of the Trump presidency. So we have to be on guard. We are doing that at the ACLJ. We're already in federal court on other election integrity issues. It's the most important time of the year for us. Welcome back to Secular. We are taking your calls to 1-800-684-3110. That's 1-800-684-3110. So I want to go to the phones as they start coming in too, so we can start answering more questions with Marie on line one from Colorado. Marie, you're on the air.
Yes. I've been watching the news lately, and President Trump is talking about deporting all of these illegal immigrants, starting with the criminals and the rapists and the degenerates and all that. What country would he deport them to? Because as I understand, Venezuela has already said they don't want theirs back.
They could say that. Usually you would be sent back to your country of origin. So again, there may be countries that are more difficult for the U.S., but I mean, to deny that they don't want their individuals back, I think that's something the U.S. would have to deal with. I haven't heard from a lot of other countries that have made it that clear. Remember, Venezuela sees us more of almost like an enemy, or does see us like an enemy, and harbors a lot of our enemies to be closer to the United States. But I mean, outside of Venezuela, I mean, to the other countries, the process is you are ultimately returned to your country of origin, and that these would not be people that were, again, these are not people who were seeking some kind of special status, refugee status, because of concerns at their home country. These are usually economic-based migrants, and they want to do it in a more humane way, so that if it's like a family that's come together illegally, that the whole family will be sent together. So it's not going to be some separation issue. And a lot of this is not going to be focusing on people who have just come across and merely for those economic reasons. I think that's probably the bottom of this list. The priority on this list are the cartels, those with multiple, with felony convictions, those who are known criminals or even terrorists inside their own countries of origin and now inside the United States. The drug cartels, obviously the drug dealers from those cartels. So you kind of start with the worst,
right?
And you work your way down. And some of those, again, could put forth dangerous situations, which is why you've got to beef up ICE, you've got to beef up Customs and Border Patrol, so that they're ready to go with some of these darker and more sinister actors that we know are in our country. And we saw like what happened in Colorado when Democrats tried to mock that. Obviously, the rest of the country did not think mocking that was a good idea.
That's right. And also, to Marie's point, a lot of these countries in Central America do already receive a vast amount of American humanitarian aid, assistance from the federal government. A lot of them don't have a lot of tools in their toolbox to push back against an American administration saying, listen, we found a citizen of yours. They are a criminal migrant. They are here illegally. You are taking them back. Venezuela also may push back, but once again, sanctions, cutting off their shipping ports. There are a wide variety of tools the American government has, being the strongest nation in the world, to push back on a smaller developing nation that's trying to say you can't send a criminal migrant that left our country and went to your country illegally back. There are many ways for the administration to accomplish this, especially when dealing with these really bad actors. This morning, the trial for the killer of Lake and Riley out of Georgia started. That was a Venezuelan illegal immigrant. I saw that he has requested a trial without a jury. He is allowing the judge to decide his fate in that case. So these individuals that are here, when they are caught by the government, now that there is a government that has this mandate to clean up the American cities that are being overrun by this migrant crime, I think that there is a lot of ways, and I'm very happy that the border czar will be Tom Homan. He's taking the job from Vice President Harris and is going to completely change that way that this border czar position is taken. And I think that he has the will and the strength and also the pedigree of his years in this world of border enforcement to make sure that this is a priority of the Trump administration.
Right. And then DHS will need appointment of Customs and Border Patrol and ICE. So all of that will be coming as well. We haven't had names there, but you're going to have someone in the White House who is advising President Trump, Tom Homan, on those issues daily, because that is a top priority for President Trump once he enters in the White House and officially can start making those decisions, and not just decisions, but then turning them into orders. If you want to talk to us on air, 1-800-684-3110. It's interesting that John Fetterman, a Democrat senator, has already come out in support of Secretary of State for Rubio. He says a strong choice. They disagree on some things, but he'd vote to confirm him. So you see that some of these confirmations, and I think because of the difference in this, first of all, Fetterman has turned out to be a very different senator than people predicted. And I think especially on, he's much more independent and less much, it says he no longer really considers himself that, uses that progressive term. He's been very pro-Israel as well. So I think he looked at those issues that are happening around the world, and one of those top issues involves Israel. So we'll see how many more of those statements come out. Remember, Republican senators right now are preparing to vote on their next leader. That is a very secretive vote tomorrow. So you don't, we know that sometimes it goes through rounds of votes. We know right now the main three candidates are John Thune, John Cornyn, and then Rick Scott. There could be others that put their name forward. We know that at least those three, that there are people who have committed to voting for them. It will then, you know, still usually if there's three, you'd go to at least a second round to get a leader. But we should know tomorrow who the next Republican leader in the U.S. Senate will be. So that is how that vote is done. Remember, the speaker vote is done a little bit differently, and that is a more public vote. And so, again, we will, of course, watch all of that leadership with Elise Stefanik. That there's the House Conference Chair, which is the fourth highest position in House leadership, moving as well. So, again, if you want to talk to us, 1-800-684-3110. I did want to take a second to say, look, you know, we got an election a week ago, but our work to defend election integrity is far from over. And you've heard about today. I can't really underscore this enough, because we got more than a dozen House races still too close to call. Some that will have recounts. Others that have not even been called yet. Five or six that have not been called. One only has 57% of the votes counted. But the radical left, they are desperately filing lawsuits to allow votes that should not be counted, thus illegal votes, and we have to fight back. That's why our 2024 Faith and Freedom Drive is built for. It's built to fight. Just hours ago, we filed a critical brief in federal court on, again, election observers to defend election integrity now and in the future, and we're prepared to take that all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court if necessary. We're near our 250,000 signature goal to defend election integrity because we've got these majorities coming in. Now is the time to do it. We've got to get the legislation through. Sign our petition at aclj.org/vote. Now, some can be done at the federal level. Other work has to be done at the state level. We need to work at both levels, and we will at the ACLJ through the ACLJ and ACLJ Action. And I also just want you to know the reason why we launched this Faith and Freedom Drive is because these next couple of months that you're hearing us on the broadcast, November and December, are the two most critical times of the, is the most critical time of the year in determining the kind of resources we have to kick off 2025, a new presidential administration, a new Senate majority, a likely slim House majority that continues on, so that we can really get to work both in Washington, D.C., and of course in courts in our country and around the world. But we need you to stand with us, and we need your support. So it's how we prepare to know what we've got, so how what we can use, who can we add to the staff, what kind of staff do we need to add to deal with the change that's coming in Washington, D.C. A lot of that is positive change, but we have to have the resources to add those people so that we get, again, the most impact we can for you in our country, both in the courts, in the halls of power. So go to aclj.org right now. Your gift will be doubled. So if you donate $25, that's like $50. If you donate $100, that's like $200 to us. A $25 donation, $10 donation, whatever you can donate, donate today, because it's such an important time for us to prepare to take these victories and utilize them. Because, again, the victories are great, but if you don't utilize them and you're not ready to go and you don't have a strategic plan and people in place, things don't get done in Washington, D.C. We all know that, don't we? So we want to make sure we've got the resources to do everything we can for you, our members and donors and supporters at the ACLJ. So donate today at aclj.org. Double the impact of that donation.
That's right, Jordan. And as we head into this next segment, we will be joined by our director of our ACLJ Jerusalem office, Jeff Balaban, to talk about also something we talked about yesterday. We talked about the horrific attack on Israelis and Jews in Amsterdam. Now there is a soccer match between the national teams of Israel and France that is slated to be played in Paris. And the French are already concerned of similar actions happening there. They're sending 4,000 police officers to be on patrol around the stadium and throughout Paris during this. The Israeli government has already cautioned Israelis not to go. And we'll talk with Jeff on the ground in Israel about all of these things coming up in the next segment. But as Jordan said, now is a very important time to support the work of the ACLJ. We are in our Faith and Freedom Drive. You can go to aclj.org and you can donate today. Any gift is doubled at aclj.org, and it helps us shore up our resources as we look at the fights ahead. We know that it's not just rooting out the radical left in the deep state, but also the liberal states whose governors have already said they have a mandate to push back against President Trump's agenda. We'll be fighting there as well. Go to aclj.org today.
To Seculo. We're about to be joined by Jeff Balaban, who is in ACLJ Jerusalem. Should we take a call first, Will?
Yeah, let's go ahead and go to Phoebe calling from New Jersey on line one. Phoebe, you're on Seculo.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. And I just want to say thank you for all the hard work that you do over the years for We the People. You're just an amazing organization.
Thank you so much.
My question is that before the deportation of first the most heinous and serious criminals back to their home country, should President Trump and his new border czar, should they pause and think of when these people are deported back, which you said before they're poor, you know, these are poor countries. I'm just concerned that they can break out of whatever jail or prison they're in, and they have contacts here in the U.S., and they can find their way back into the U.S. and commit more crimes. So are the communities in the United States safer with these people behind bars in a U.S. prison
I think let me just answer for you really quick. I don't think we're going to be emptying prisons yet. So we're talking about like these cartel elements that have taken over, that they have been held by ICE, that we know where they are. So if we know that you have a dangerous past, or that you haven't actually been convicted and sentenced yet, that's different. Then the dealing with people who have been sentenced to long prison sentences because of violent crime, that has to be handled in a totally different way, Will. So that's what we're talking about here, is the people we know that are here illegally, and you start with those who have connections to bad elements, whether it's trafficking, some other additional issue other than just being here illegally. You start there, and then you move along.
Well, and as well as it's
we're not going to be just emptying out prisons to countries that are going to let them come right back here.
But it's also strengthening the border. It's
right.
Not
that's
just
very important.
Deportation. It's also strengthening the border. But we also are joined now by Jeff Balaban, our director of ACLJ Jerusalem. Jeff just got to Israel, so we are thankful to have him on, and we'll be hearing more from him in the coming days ahead. But Jeff, there's a soccer match between the Israeli national team and the French national team in just 2 days after what we saw in Amsterdam last week. The concern, both from French authorities and the Israelis, is that this pogrom that happened in Amsterdam could find its way in Paris. What are you hearing?
Sure. Look, what happened in Amsterdam, I mean, we've been watching terrible things around the streets of the world, chanting, kill the Jews, gas the Jews. Crime against Jews has been up everywhere, including the United States of America. I think that for a lot of us, especially people who grew up in Holocaust families, but even for people who are just aware of the past, the not so distant past, seeing these things happen in the heart of where the Holocaust took place, seeing these things happen in Anne Frank's city, it's a level of actually trauma triggering. It just triggers trauma. more than almost anything else. Even here in Israel, I just came back here now, but I was hearing from friends here that seeing those scenes struck a new chord of not fear, but just a sense of a new low of humanity.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff, the idea here is France taking it very seriously. I mean, you've got Israel saying, taking it seriously too, encouraging Israelis not to travel to France. There will still be a contingent of likely fans who are either Jewish or Israeli who live in or around Paris. So France has decided to treat this as a very serious event. They had a term for it. They treat it as like a, it's not a terrorist event, but as an event of particular concern.
Right.
So they're adding an additional 4,000 security forces. I mean, so they're preparing for the potential of serious violence. That's a good thing, Jeff. And I think something that other European countries have got to look to is to make sure that if they're inviting Israel or Israeli teams to big public events, they need to make sure that the people that are going to those events for both teams and for the people of the that live in those areas, that they are protected, whether they are citizens of France or citizens of the state of Israel.
That's definitely right. And, you know, just the last segment I heard as I'm tuning in, people talking about America's border and American immigration. I mean, what happened here is that Europe, largely in a reaction to the Holocaust, said, well, we don't want to be xenophobic. We don't want to be haters. And so they threw open the borders to the people who actually are xenophobic and haters. It wasn't done very wisely. And the fact is that in the United States of America, the border problem is a problem on many accounts. Fentanyl, jobs, you know, terror, crime, but also because we have an unspecified number of jihadis or people with these attitudes who are in America now. And so, yes, this is a concern globally. And it's very important that all nations that have allowed these elements into their country deal with these things, because we see they turn physically violent. I'd also like to add, by the way, and I apologize, see, this is not usually how I show up on a screen when we're talking here on Seculo. I just came straight from the airport, and we were late because I don't know if you saw the news that there were some Hezbollah rockets that were either aimed towards or heading towards Ben-Gurion, the airport here. So our plane, as others, were circling for a while. Thank God nobody was hurt by those rockets.
Yeah, I mean, that's just a reality of, you know, just traveling. Like you said, Jeff, I mean, it's becoming all too normal. It can't become the norm for Israel, even though for these past over a year it has been. But I do want to look at some positives as well. I have seen a lot of surveys coming out, and even those on the left in Israel who would usually not be behind a Republican presidential candidate are at least being honest that they believe that the incoming administration with President Trump at the helm is going to be much better for the state of Israel. I think right away we see Elise Stefanik at the United Nations, and she is one of the most outspoken and strong supporters of Israel in the U.S. House of Representatives. She made that even part of her official statement accepting the nomination, talking about Israel and standing with Israel at the United Nations and against anti-Semitism. So the state of Israel, it wasn't just Prime Minister Netanyahu that was very excited about the change, but it seems like the people as a whole, regardless of where they are kind of on a political spectrum inside Israel, are hopeful that things are going to change rapidly for the support that they receive from the United States.
Let's also add to that hope that the Democrats, having been so roundly trounced on so many levels,
right,
when they reconsider, hopefully, some of the more radical positions they've taken, they'll maybe reconsider their departure from being a true friend and ally to Israel in the way they had been in the past. And hopefully this will be an overall, you know, reckoning in that party, because the truth is the vast majority of Americans do support a very strong alliance with the sole real ally in the Middle East.
You're right. I mean, we work together on technologies that then help U.S. troops when we deploy. Israel is on the front line, so they usually are the ones testing them out to see, like, things like the Iron Dome, which have become much more mobile and then can be utilized to protect our troops all over the world. We see as things have heated up, we hope that a stronger U.S. diplomatically can also bring some of those tensions to ease some of those tensions, so that Israel is not in these multi-conflicts, so that we get whether it's bodies or people who are still alive, hostages returned. And Jeff, so there's a lot of work for the incoming administration even to do in this transition period, but it does seem, just with 10 seconds left here, that there's some new hope inside the state of Israel.
Absolutely. Even the names being rumored for a new Secretary of State would be spectacular. And also, I think, Jordan, we know it's a lot. It also changes kind of the nature of the work we do here in Jerusalem in a much more proactive way.
Yeah, of course it does. Of course it does. Because, again, having that close alliance with the U.S. government and our international officials and the Israeli officials. Support the work of the ACLJ. I mean, as you heard from Jeff, this is how we do that work, with your financial support. Jeff is there. Our team is there. And we're about to, I think, increase the ability to work there. So let's be ready. Donate to the ACLJ at ACLJ.org right now, and your gift will be doubled during our Faith and Freedom Drive. Donate today, ACLJ.org. It's so important. We need your financial contribution. This is so important for the beginning of the year as well. Donate today. We'll talk to you tomorrow.